It is borne out in later results. Machiavelli allows the possibility that the original sin, the foundation crime, might actually turn out to be a blessing for society. It must be understood that Augustine was not writing in ignorance of the pagan practice of foundation sacrifice. His De Civitate Dei is decidedly contra paganos. In this sense, of course, Cain is no sacred executioner, Abel is no bouc émissaire, and while this is obviously true of Cain and Abel, the same denial extends to Romulus and Remus. Augustine's recourse to the idea of the two cities deprives one of the cities, the earthly city, of its full status and validity. It is marred in its very origins and bears a fundamental liability. No good can ever come from Romulus's violent act, and as a foundation sacrifice, it is invalid. Romulus is no hero, and Remus is no martyr. The death of the one is not a cleansing act, an act of purification, an expiation that augurs well for the city. It does not put an end to violence. Rather, it has known a violent commencement that will surely have an answerable sequestration. Significantly, the city does not have the resources to overcome this original sin. Augustine would consider the pagan view to be overly sanguine. From blood there can come no hope, only more blood. The only hope lies in the martyred Abel, whose virtues are not of the earthly city, but which rather show the way to the heavenly city. Machiavelli is a revolutionary thinker because he turned Augustine and Dante's views upside down and effected a return to the prior pagan conception, where Romulus, who enjoyed archetypal association with Cain and Augustine's account, becomes a sacred executioner from whose actions many good things accrued to Rome. Machiavelli's horizons are unmistakably historical and political. Where Augustine deals with two cities, a procedure that almost necessarily demotes the earthly city, Machiavelli has limited his perspective to man and history to one city. There are no references to theological solutions, but the same limitation has tragic implications. If in Machiavelli's thought, the foundation crime may in certain circumstances be overcome, this is not without pain and difficulty. Since he accepts as a political fact that only one person can found a state, almost of necessity then, mythical and real brothers are pitted one against the other in the dire dilemma of political power. Conflict becomes his supreme mythos. His vision of power is exclusive, precisely the view that Dante and Augustine both wish to transcend in their visions of the inclusiveness of charity. Nevertheless, despite these grim but acceptably harsh conditions, Machiavelli still embraces the Renaissance vision of possibility. Some founding fathers have emerged who do have the continuing and larger good of the polis and the people as their primary aim. Their intentions and the consequences of their actions must be considered. The new prince must be ready to enter into evil and to endure the stain of bloodshed. The quandary with which Machiavelli confronts his new or founding prince is far more difficult than that facing Plato's philosopher king. Machiavelli has brought the traditional dilemma into history, into critical moments of choice and power. Machiavelli's prince must be willing to enter into history, commit actions that are at least morally ambiguous, and by means of these very actions must produce institutions that are viable and that contribute to the order and stability of his people. The dictatorship of this revolutionary prince must yield to the republic of law and institutions. Machiavelli affects this possible regeneration of the Cain-Romulus figure by, as I say, creating space around the event. That is, he makes room for revised judgment. This means that the malefactor, if that is what he is not irrecoverably evil. And this is a distinctive contribution to the eventual rehabilitation of Cain. In fact, evil is not radical in the theological sense of St. Paul, the mystery of iniquities, of Melville, the wantonness of malignity, of Coleridge's account of Iago, motiveless malignity. Evil is not radical in that sense. Rather, we are asked to judge actions and intentions and results. At decisive moments of history, actions are ambiguous, only to be clarified by later events. The primary question that Machiavelli asks is, Was the new prince violent in order to destroy or violent in order to mend? Was he dominated by private ambition or by the common good? In Romulus' case, and this makes Romulus the realistic and yet heroic model for the new prince, it comes clear that the Roman founder had acted for the common good and not out of private ambition. This is demonstrated by the fact that Romulus immediately organized a Senate, reserving to himself only wartime powers as commander-in-chief of the army and the power to convoke the Senate. He submitted his individual will to the general good and the rule of law. All important, then, is true intentionality, an intentionality that might be clouded in the ambiguity of historical change, but which then reveals itself in the later actions of the prince. With this important emphasis on intentionality, with the creation of space or ambiguity around the event, with the possibility that the murderer might even be a hero, a sacred executioner who in fact endures evil in order to save the state, we see what a contribution Machiavelli has made, not only to the Romulus and Remus theme, but its archetypally joined counterpart, the Cain and Abel theme. We see how he has contributed to the regeneration of Cain. We further see what contributions Machiavelli has made to the legitimation of new regimes in the early modern period, and what thematic roles Cain and Abel, Romulus and Remus, or the sacred executioner may have in elucidating these political events. Now, as one example, I'm going to close with a passage from Shakespeare. These political and thematic lessons were not lost on Shakespeare, who in his second historical tetralogy, that showing the rise to power of Henry IV and his eventual vindication by Prince Al, where indeed there are two significant references to Cain, Henry Bolingbroke is himself seen to be Machiavelli's early modern prince, the founder of a new house, a sacred executioner who enters into evil, who overthrows his monarch, and yet enjoys ultimate legitimation. Clearly, Shakespeare makes reference to the blood beginnings at the foundation of the new state when at the end of Richard II, the already weary, harassed usurper, confronted with the corpse of his predecessor, protests that he is full of woe, that blood should sprinkle me to make me grow. But later, when his efforts are redeemed in the good resolutions of his son, when Prince Hal shows his own respect for law, the submission of individual caprice and lust for power to the stable order and good rule of the state, Henry IV recognizes that he has been both sacred executioner and scapegoat. With his death, he will, quote, take all the soil of the achievement, a marvelous phrase, the soil of the achievement with him into the grave. That is the elementary taint of effecting historical change, the blood shed at acquisition. The reasons for his expiation are too many to discuss here, but clearly, in the overall judgment of the play, his earlier motives are retrospectively revealed in his solicitous concern for the good rule of his son. The changes that Machiavelli effected in the larger theme of hostile brothers has made a distinct contribution to the possibilities of regeneration and the newer climate in which we shall see Cain undergo even further changes. Thank you.
Who would ask if he were here?
Tom Hill would ask if he were here. Have you found any more any significant uses in that curious business about Cain being the only one to deflower his virgin grandmother by shedding blood upon the as yet innocent earth? But of course, the earth is in a sense his grandmother, since Adam was born of the earth. Cain was the first to deflower his virgin grandmother. Wolfram uses it in Parsifal. And Tom has found it in the Old English Adrian and Ritheus. Have you run across it anywhere else?
No. As you know, there are very, very commonplace, of course, that Cain actually had intercourse with Eve.
Oh, yeah.
These are very, very common to you, I'm sure. But the one of deflowering his virgin is a beauty.
It certainly is.
We're no longer on tape, are we? That is a marvelous one. I haven't come across it, but give me the specifics on that one afterwards.
It's very prominently in Wolfram's Parsifal. That's the big literary use.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that marvelous? Either one, yes.
I didn't understand your reference to more modern things in your almost last sentence. What did you have in mind?
Oh my goodness. Well, that's the larger portion of the book. If you think of
Solomon Gessner, the Totopoulos, the 18th century revision of the Cain and Abel story is enormous. As you know, the Enlightenment is the period of our cultural past now undergoing most extensive revision. And from the period of intellectual program.
In a general sense.
Yes.
Well, there is a striking modern instance. I don't know if you would consider it or not. And that is the sacred share.
Oh, it is just superb. In fact, it figures centrally in my book. There are six explicit references, quotations from the Genesis 4, as you know, in the secret sharer. And Leggett is one of the most wonderful of Cain characters, the ultimate legitimation. Unlike Byron's Cain, he is not a tormented character. He's a very sane person who, in that vacuum of authority, may have killed someone against that, again, that ambiguity or space around the event. We don't know if he killed the person, do we? Possibly, probably, but there's some ambiguity there. He saves the ship. Not only does he save the ship, but he saves the young captain later on. I mean, he is a perfect sacred executioner. That is, he must go through life bearing the burden of not having the mark of Cain. This is one of the most splendid uses of the whole idea of the mark of Cain, that he does not have that saving mark on his sane forehead to save him. It's just a superb example of what happens to the Cain and Abel story.
And the two figures become like twins.
And the whole idea of the double. This is an important development in the story. When the story is confined and insulated, then it's very hard for Cain to break out of guilt. Once he has a double, it's like you're going from the nuclear to the extended family, then it is possible to diffuse some of that contractive energy which we have in the and confinement we have in the story. So the growth of the double is a remarkable. No, the secret share is a glorious story, and particularly in this line of thought. Absolutely, yes. Are we going to ask about the same one?
No, not about the same one. I was just wondering how you might respond to the suggestion that Cain, rather than being the originator of evil, is instead the originator of bad taste. And starting, say, with Joyce's Shem, who writes with his own excrement on his own body, as a form of self-referring writing, which is supposed to be in bad taste in every way, to Grendel, who's a meok stuff, a stepper along the borders, or perhaps even a stepper over the borders, as Remus was.
Bad taste is offensive to civilization.
what this would do would perhaps reverse what Augustine was suggesting and make, in fact, Remus the Cain figure, because he stepped over.
Your suggestion of Finnegan's Wake is a good one, because this is just what does happen. And this is the great contrast, say, between Romanticism and Modernism. In Romanticism and Cain and Abel's story, while the Romantic period was revolutionary in what it did, in the changes it affected, it kept the same dynamic, that is, a seesaw dynamic. Instead of Cain, as it was in Christianity, being heir to Satan, and Abel being a saint, they just turned that around, and in the 19th century witnessed a progressive degradation of and emotion of Abel and the glorification of Cain. So what all that does is it continues psychologically the same seesaw effect, the evaluative effect that we had in the Christian epoch. With modernism, this is turned around, and the Shem and Shan become at times interchangeable, they have the same voice patterns. Abel becomes a tremendous worldly success, charmingly, and in the marvelous phrase, which I love to quote because it has so much Sean is Abel boobied.
Not only is he a booby, but he has boobs as well. The predominant Cain, Abel, from being the martyr figure, has become the successful man of history. And Joyce traces the history of our time. Finnegan's Wake is just marvelous. And Joyce traces the history of our time in the devolution of the character of Abel, who is the leader of his time, and he becomes notorious, as you know, beyond. And we heard that on TV the other night. He is also, and here's another wonderful phrase, Raumi Bolt, he's a space character, right? And of course, all this comes out of the Joyce's quarrel with Wyndham Lewis and Time Western Man. And Joyce had that wonderful capacity to take attacks and aggravations into himself and make it into the work of literature. And so Sean, the Abel character, becomes the space character, Raumi, as well as being the Rome character, that is the imperialistic character, who sends his directives out, and they are bulls, right? Any medievalist, any allegorist, any man with multiple interpretations, it's a field day. And since my friend and former student and dear friend Jonathan Culler is here, Jonathan, here's another one from Finnegan's Wake, which you will love. In the tavern episode, where HCE is about to be dismembered, Joyce not only gives us radio and television replays of it, of the event, but he also deals with the obnihilization of the etim, not only the death of the father, Adam. You see, Adam and the atom, which was, of course, the splitting of the atom occurred in the 30s. Joyce, amazing, incorporates this into his work. And so we have there the abnus, but he also associates that with, guess what? The abnivalization of the true foundation of the word. Abnivalization of the etym, which is just what a wonderful associative mind. All postmodernism derives from that phrase. Yes, Rob.
I just wanted to ask, what you do with the complicity in crime of Ulysses and Diomedes in the Dante canto versus the rivalry of the fair enemy motif.
Versus the what?
The hostile brother.
Yeah, motif. Well, what I do is, what I would have to do, of course, is that they went together in Siamo al Vendetto, come vanno a lire, right? So they were, but the point is, Diomedes doesn't speak. And what I'm trying to make much of, now, as I said, this is a slender thread I'm going to build a major discourse, but which I'm trying to make much of is the metaphoric association with Eteocles and Polynices. And it doesn't work, of course, if we see them as partners, but then if they are partners, why should he have described them as rival brothers? You see, so I think that takes precedence, or I would suggest it does.
Rick, you could also say, couldn't you, in answer to Ravi, that Ulysses seduced Diomedes? It was Ulysses' idea in the first place to go on that expedition. He seduced Diomedes the same way he's pictured as seducing his men to go on the final voyage.
Yes, yeah.
So in a sense, although they were partners, he was also against him spiritually.
He was the original con artist. That is Dante's interpretation. But he does place him in a context, and I think that Cain and Abel, or Frères Ennemis, rather than Cain and Abel in this particular case, a larger motif, does help us understand why, does give us added perspective on Ulysses, that Dante was intent on historicizing giving him a brother and giving him spiritual descendants.
And what Carol was saying about the seduction of Diomedes, he does call his companions frati, brothers, and when he leads them to their own annihilation. But I don't know if I could find a Girardian kind of mimetic rivalry or some kind of the frère ennemi motif in that kind of seducing into complicity instead of the act of fratricide. I don't know. That's the only.
Yes?
There's also the column in Francesca who are joined together and then the brother kills
the brother. Yes, right there. And that that is slightly different from what that is a kind of a natural product of, as far as Dante is concerned. I'm not speaking about my own feelings on the matter, right? As far as Dante is concerned, that is a natural product of their affections. They are stuck with one another. That's what he's saying. And but when we come to the lower Inferno, the return to this tight connection becomes grotesque, as it does with Ugolino. So it's there. But you can make many, many connections between the two, obviously, as you all have done. I would only bore you with that. Yes?
It's been a long time since I've read the Inferno, but I remember that Ulysses passage as having great nobility.
Oh, yes.
It moved through 100 characters. Reach the opposite end. Don't you think that affects one's view of things and the respectfulness with which Dante addresses him and so forth?
Well, we're going to get into the whole quarrel, are we not? And, obviously, disturbing speech. And obviously, Dante is finding a great mythic figure to represent what he thinks are the tremendous virtues of Florence. They were the great entrepreneurs, the merchant adventurers of the 14th century, their banking enterprise and all. But you could also say that Dante would like to say, as people said about Los Angeles, I saw the future and I didn't like it.
The verse seems to me to say otherwise. The
stage is a marvelous thing.
In its place in the Inferno says one thing. Itself.
Yeah, well, the speech is stirring, and obviously there are a great many associations between this freebooter that Dante felt in himself and the nobility of his humanistic vision. But in a way, if you immediately followed with what Ulysses says afterwards, he's somewhat of a con artist. He is showing you, he is demonstrating his rhetorical abilities. And he's showing you how he is able to stir his men to go on this journey, which is a trespass, as far as Dante is concerned. Of course, as I say, your reaction is a perfectly valid one, because Ulysses was vindicated and Dante was not.
Anyone who would like to continue this discussion is welcome to.